follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express. You're slowly returning to being Fortnightly Podcast, chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's show, I'm talking to writer-director Pat Higgins about his upcoming movie, Power Tool Cheerleaders vs. the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead. Over the course of the interview, I chat to Pat about that title, how it doesn't really work as an acronym, and we end up kind of playing a game of how many times can we say the title in full throughout the episode, which I think ends up being quite a lot of fun. Hopefully it's not too patience testing for you listeners. Plus, we get into the actual making of the movie. Pat gives a bit of a tutorial on how to run a Kickstarter campaign for a film. And we get into various other facets of his 20-year-long career within horror. All of which you can hear right now in my interview with Pat. Hi, Pat. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hi, Scott. Fantastic to be here.
Good. Well, it's good that it's nice to be here. And I'd hate for a guest to be like, well, I was ordered to do this.
Exactly. Well, I think I've covered up quite well the sheer duress I was put under to be here today. So, yeah, but if your audience believes it's nice for me to be here, then that works for me, man. That's cool.
Other former guests bullying you into coming on to the show.
It's been relentless, man. It's been nothing but just endless voicemail messages. Man, if you don't go on that show, I'm going to track you down. Just like horrible, violent threats from countless other people just telling me that I need to be on the show. So that's why I'm here.
Yes.
And because I've been looking forward to it.
Oh, well, that's good. So enough of that nonsense. We've got you on the show today to talk about many things, but mostly about your most recent film, Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead. I think I've got that
the
right.
One. Yeah. Okay. You have indeed. And we do need to say the title in full every single time it's mentioned. There'll be none of this abbreviating it to PTCLVBBSD or anything like that. We need the full title every single time.
Okay,
it's a contractual obligation.
I mean, if we abbreviate it, PCVTBBOTSD is quite a mouthful.
Yeah, as abbreviations go, it doesn't really fulfill its purpose of making it easier to say the title. So, there you go.
Okay. Sticking with that, for the audience, can you, first of all, give a brief spoiler-free synopsis of, wait for it, Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead?
I certainly will, Scott. Thank you very much. Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead tells the story of, it's a TV talent show, basically. We have a TV talent show where we're approaching the kind of final rounds of it. We've got a girl cheerleading group. We've got a very talented boy band with all the kind of slick moves and the shiny suits and all that sort of thing. There's a kind of rivalry between the two groups, and then things take a turn for the slightly apocalyptic as a cursed amulet comes into play. And before you know it, we are up to our elbows in kind of zombies and songs, because it is a musical. We go full tilt down the TV talent show bloodbath kind of vibe.
And where did the initial idea come from? I understand that you had like an old script that you re kind of formulated into this movie. Is that correct?
Not quite. There was. I always have a bunch of movie scripts on the go at any given time, and on this particular occasion, Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead was on the pile of scripts that aren't doing too well. You know, the kind of life support pile of scripts where you're thinking, yeah, this. I don't think this script's going to make it. I don't think this script will ever be on the silvery screen. I think this script will be stripped for parts and will end up elsewhere. And because I'm sort of fairly gobby on social media from time to time, I posted out on that saying, you know, every now and again a script doesn't make it. And I think today's the day I finally give up on Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead. And as soon as I tweeted that, Charlie Bond, the incredibly talented Charlie Bond, who is an actor and she is a producer, and she just said, oh no, God, we're going to make that. And she just replied to the tweet and just said, no, you're not going to stop writing that. We're going to make that movie. And she just basically willed it into life at that point. She started putting out feelers for other people who might be involved. And it was basically me saying, yeah, I'm giving up on this script was the absolute impetus to, by the end of the afternoon, it became very, very clear that I would be making the movie. So yeah, that was kind of how it came about, which was an unusual sort of birth for it. I mean, we both Charlie and I had worked previously on a movie called Strippers versus Werewolves, which is another kind of boy gang, girl gang movie in a similar kind of vein. But Strippers versus Werewolves was a very horrible experience for most people involved with it. So we were very eager to kind of go back and right the wrongs that had been done by that process, I suppose, and make something that was fun and upbeat and that we could really kind of stand by and go, you know, as movies with goofy titles go, this one's a really good one.
I'm now curious as to, can you discuss why Stripper versus Werewolves was a terrible experience, or is that something you'd rather not discuss on the recording?
Yeah, it's well for my own sanity, you know, it's one of the things you kind of it was an experience where there were a lot of people pulling in a lot of different directions. There were a lot of people who were very wonderful and talented people who worked very, very hard and then saw their work not it through its best lens. And so I think it was quite sad and quite frustrating for quite a lot of really, really nice human beings who deserved a better experience would be unfortunately what I'd say about it. And I don't think the film so a lot of people I think had a very unhappy time. And then I think the film that came out the other end didn't justify quite how many talented people had had quite such an unhappy time. So I think a few of us people who'd been involved with it were quite eager for the idea of, you know, that any movie that was in any kind of similar ballpark. And this is, you know, at the end of the day, it is a group of girls, group of boys, antagonism kind of movie. It's a versus movie. But I think everyone was quite eager to make sure that everybody had a brilliant time on this and that it fulfilled the potential any potential it had from my initial kind of idea that came through onto the page, onto the screen rather.
And I was wondering, how long did it take you to kind of work more on the script? Like, what was the process like from taking it off the extinction pile and into the being made
Well, yeah,
pile?
it was. I mean, that was an oddly quick process because, as I say, Charlie just grabbed it and ran with it. And she was just like, you know, as long as you're on board, we're doing this. And then we had a meeting in London and just sort of, which I'm trying to remember the chronology of it, whether that was actually maybe even the first time we'd actually met face to face, although we'd previously worked on films together. You know, if I end up on things as a writer only, you know, you're not always there on set and all those sorts of things. But yeah, we met up in London and it became fairly apparent after chatting that she was absolutely serious, having read scripts by me before and kind of knowing at least where it was likely to end up sitting, in terms of tone and all of those sorts of things. And so I had a meeting with her and a meeting with James Hamer Morton, who is our musical director. He's also doing the edit and he's one of our leads as well. So we've got a lot of very multi-talented people involved in the whole process. And as I say, yeah, it became very, very obvious very quickly that, yeah, Charlie was entirely sincere and that we were just going to go ahead and do this movie. And so once that became clear, we started putting together a package, that where we thought, okay, we can get some of our cast together, and then we can maybe shoot a day, a kind of proof of concept for Kickstarter, which is what we did. And then, so we did one day shooting for Kickstarter, and then we were at least at some points in October of that year, the most popular film Kickstarter on the planet. So that came together quite well, that one day shoot as a proof of concept kind of deal. And so we hit our Kickstarter target and we were off and running, and we shot our first shots of it about 6 weeks after the first money came in from Kickstarter.
Awesome. Yeah, I did see that article that was like, at some point you were the most popular Kickstarter film in the world.
That was one of those things. Well, it's one of those things I thought, you know what it's like. You sit there and you think, yeah, that can't be right. Because you search it, because you vanity Google. It's like every now and again in my career, I've had these things where Google has thrown something at me where I thought, that can't be right. And it's always when I'm doing that furtive vanity Google of my own stuff kind of thing. And in this case, I went up to Kickstarter and I put the filters on it. Like, okay, sort film projects by popularity over the planet Earth. I think it actually has the setting as. And I did it, and ours came up first. And I thought, this must be something in the cache, or, you know, it must be that it's logged something that, because I've been searching, that goes, oh yeah, there's your film. We know what you're looking for, mate. But so I phoned a friend of mine in New York. I go, can you just check? And he's like, yeah, no, that's your film. And it's like, okay. So yeah, that was one of those happy occasions. The previous one, actually, many, many years ago, was I made a micro budget movie in about 2006. Where we ended up selling the worldwide rights, and we completely lost track of where this movie had come out, what had happened with it, and all this. But it was a very, very low budget movie. The first shot of it's shot in my back garden, it's that sort of thing. And one day I vanity Googled that and found it on the UCI cinema chain website in Germany, and it got a cinema release in Germany, and no one had told me. And so, you know, you do get these things sometimes as an indie filmmaker where you just search something up and you go, oh, or at least I do, where you go, oh, well, that's not a thing I expected. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, no, I know. I suppose, like, sometimes, you know, sometimes these things happen. You know, I'm a very, very small independent podcast with loyal listeners. I appreciate my audience, but it's not like it's the biggest podcast. But sometimes, every so often, something will happen. Like, you know, I follow my podcast on a website called Chartable, and at one point I was the kind of subcategory that I'm in is like film interviews, and at one point I was like number one in South Africa in film interviews. So
nice, congratulations, man.
Very briefly for like a day or something, but yeah, it's like, you know, these are the things.
They're the things that keep you going. It's the little surprises where you just go, well, you know what? You know, this reached some people, man.
It did. So I understand where you're coming from. So was it quite quick to reach your target then? Kickstarter-wise?
It flew off the blocks. And then for anybody who's ever run a Kickstarter campaign, you'll find that there's like a week in the middle where it's dead, where you just think, something's broken here. You know, you go from here's a donation, here's another donation, here's another donation, and then there's no one cares anymore, no one likes your film. And it really is incredibly demoralizing, because you feel like, you know, like you're off and running, and you kind of have this ticking thing where you get used to it in the back of your head, where you go, all right, well, even on a bad day we'll bring in this much, you know, X, somewhere between X and Y. No, on a bad day, you will bring in nothing. And it almost feels like people are cancelling ones that are already there, you know. So like, it's just so it started off just flying, and then it just stopped dead, no matter what we were doing. And I mean, Charlie and James did a kind of endless live stream where they were taking shots at some point when donations were coming in and all these sorts of things. And, you know, all this kind of real, come on, everybody, stuff, and nothing, just crickets. But, and then as soon as it gets into the last sort of quarter of the campaign, it just took off again. So it really, really did feel like that middle stretch is murder. And looking back on it, you know, you do kind of look at that and go, oh God. But the lesson for anybody out there thinking of doing a Kickstarter for an indie movie, the thing that I would recommend is that to know in advance that you're likely to get this dead spot in the middle, and also to make sure that on your proof of concept shoot day or whatever you use to kind of kick the whole process off, that you stockpile loads and loads and loads of stuff that you can drip feed out throughout the 30 days. Or however long your campaign is. So we were dropping new stuff every day, which, as I say, does make it even more disheartening when you hit that middle of the campaign and suddenly no one cares about your film anymore. Whereas it felt like a week ago, everyone was like, wow, I can't open my wallet wide enough for you. Then suddenly it was just like, no. But the fact that we were able to keep dropping new photos, we dropped a music video, we did, as I say, live streams. I dug out some old talks that I'd given at different times, and then we streamed those over Facebook. It was just sort of anything to keep that churning, to keep that a level of awareness, so it didn't just feel like, because unless you've got stuff to drop, it's just you asking for money, and no one wants you asking for money. People want, you know, here's a new exclusive picture, here's a bit of one of the songs, here's a whatever, here's a funny live feed. All that stuff generates stuff really well, but as soon as it just turns into, once you've run out of all that, it's just go on, give us money, and that doesn't work.
Yeah, right. That makes sense. And I suppose the thing about like it kind of being dead in the middle kind of makes sense. It kind of intuitively makes sense as well, because like, you know, at the start you're shiny and new, and also at the end it feels like, you know, you've got to get in now, because if you don't get in now, you won't get in. And it's like, whereas in the middle, you know, like there'll be other kind of other things taking attention away or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no rocket boost. It doesn't matter what you do, there is no way of firing up in the middle of that campaign. I think there's always going to be that flat line, because as I say, people are kind of intrigued to see, you know, they either go, oh, they're doing all right, oh, they're doing fine, oh, they're doing, you know, they don't realize that you're sitting there looking at it against the graph where it can, you know, because you've got all these online tools where it's like, you know, if you keep getting the money coming in at this rate, then you'll hit this level and all this sort of thing. You start off going, wow, you know, we're going to make the biggest movie ever. And they're like, well, we'll hit our target. And then if everybody just stops contributing, you just watch this thing, this lovely line just tail off, and it can be soul destroying. So, but yeah, as you say, there's no impetus to kick people up the arse to actually contribute, you know, in the middle of a campaign. Even if and the people that are turning on to see the new photos or the new videos or whatever it is that you're dropping tend to be the people who've already put in early, because they're quite engaged with it, I think.
And they want to see, you know, what the progress is, you know, and absolutely. But I can also understand your point about like, yeah, making sure that you've got that content on tap, because otherwise you're just kind of shaking your can at people.
Yeah, exactly. And but I mean, you can kind of reformat it a little bit. I mean, because in our proof of concept video, there were little bits where each of the cast members, so we got all the cast members into some wardrobe. We did a load of hero shots, like backlit, cool looking hero shots and all that sort of thing. And then we kind of interviewed people about the movie, and so then we dropped little slivers of those interviews into the proof of concept video. But then that meant that we could also actually, James Hamer Morton, recut those interviews into longer format things, so we could kind of do a focus on a cast member and then drop that on a day. And then that meant that cast member's social media presence is more likely to be fired up by that as well, because it allows you that focus. So you're double dipping on the content because you've already used it. Sorry, this is just turning into a thing about crowdfunding.
No.
Blood as well, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, that's it's fine. I don't mind talking about, we'll talk about other things, so you don't have to worry about that. But I think, you know, if people are out there listening who are maybe in the process of starting to make an indie film, or they're, you know, they've got a script ready or something, you know, this could all be useful stuff for people out there.
Yeah, hopefully. It's all the stuff I wish someone had told me. I'm forever running my mouth off talking about, oh, well, it was this and this and we did this. And it all really just comes down to what things do I really wish someone had told me so that I wouldn't have to make my own mistakes. And so if there's like one indie filmmaker out there who kind of listens and goes, oh, actually, that's a good point, then my work here is done, you know.
So kind of cutting on to kind of other stuff, like obviously Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead is also,
thank you for saying the title in full.
Yes, it's okay. I'm gonna keep saying it. Throughout the interview.
Excellent. So, and then we can just do a super cut of every time you said it. just cut it back to back. And people can use it as an insomnia thing, you know, they can just drift off to Scott saying Power Tool Cheerleaders with slightly different inflections throughout the podcast.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing. I'm gonna say it in slightly different ways. I'm gonna vary the speeds as well, you know.
You're a pro at this stuff. Do a slightly sexy one, do a confused one where you go up at the end, Boy Band of the Screeching Dead. You know, it'd be really good.
Do one like I'm one of those people who eat the terms and conditions in radio adverts. So it's like Power Tool Cheerleaders from the versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead.
Oh man, that was perfect. That was disconcertingly good.
I actually am one of those people who read the term. I'm not.
Well, you know, if ever, I think there's an opening there for you, judging by that. If that was straight off the bat, that was very impressive, man.
Okay. I can't remember my question. Oh, yes. No, my question was the movie, which is, and I'll say it again, Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead, is a musical.
It is.
Had you always wanted to do a musical?
Well, I did a couple of anthology movies there's a company called Amber Pictures in Southampton, run by a guy called Jim Eaves, who is an absolute superstar, love Jim to death. And me and Jim and Al Ronald, who's my regular DOP, who's a DOP on Power Tool Cheerleaders as well, we'd made two movies in this Death Tales anthology series, which kind of went straight to DVD in 2012, something like that. And so we'd made these two movies, and I'd always lobbied to do a third Death Tales movie as a musical. And Jim had said no. He said, no, stop it. Stop asking to do it as a musical. You know, we might do a Christmas one, we might do one, but we're not doing a musical one. But there was a little sulky goblin in the back of my head going, I want to do a musical now. Now, you know, as soon as someone goes, no, don't do that. It's a terrible idea. So the little sulky goblin has sat in the back of my head going, but I want to do a musical now, since whenever we had those talks about the third Death Tales movie, which was probably in about 2013. And when Charlie Bond clicked in on this one and went, yeah, let's make this movie, I don't think at that point I'd made it entirely clear that this was sort of going to be a musical or was likely to be a musical. But luckily, when I said I'd really like to make this a musical, Charlie just went, yeah, brilliant. And so, so that came together quite easily. I love writing songs. Luckily, I have no musical talent whatsoever, but I have a great enthusiasm for writing songs. And so I like to pair up with people who are much more musically talented than I am. And then I can go, yeah, it kind of goes like this, and just sing this awful atonal nonsense. And in this case, Phil Sheldon, who I've worked with on loads of projects, he's an incredible multi-instrumentalist kind of guy. You know, he can play anything you throw at him. And so I'll send him these sort of crappy little recordings of me going, and then this song goes, blah, 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 kind of thing. And then he goes, you mean like this? And sends me back these beautiful pieces of orchestrated music. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I meant, man. And then I can kind of listen back and go, yeah, I kind of wrote that. And it's just because I surround myself with people with obscene levels of talent that I do not have.
So you wrote the lyrics for all the songs, did you?
Yeah. I can unequivocally say I wrote the lyrics. Anything beyond that is that I would sort of sit, as I say, record a thing that go, I imagine it kind of goes a bit like da 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 da. You know, and that's about as far as my musical contributions went. Actually, I've got form for this. I've done this before. That on we made a movie in 2007 called The Devil's Music, which is a fake documentary about a shock rocker who becomes convinced that a lead singer of a rival boy band is in fact the Antichrist. And so, in the course of doing that, which I'm still really proud of that movie. We shot it for very, very, very little money, but we did quite well at festivals and things like that. And we got some really, really nice reviews, got some really positive reviews. But in the course of doing that one, we had to do music because it was set in this world. So we had this shock rocker as our main character, and we needed to do the songs for that. And so it was the same thing again with Phil Sheldon, where I would send him the things going, right, this is how I sort of see it going. And he crafted these brilliant bits of kind of industrial rock, with again my lyrics sort of on the thing. And so that's how they were in that movie. But when the American distributors put that out on DVD, I'd sent them a drive that just basically had just all this stuff on it because they wanted to do a really kind of loaded up special edition. And on the original on the original DVD of that came out in the States, if you there was a hidden option on the menu, which, as I say, it wasn't us that put this together, it was the distribs, and they put it together where if you highlighted, there was one of the menu sub pictures had our main character just giving the finger to the camera, and if you went sideways, it highlighted her fingernail, and if you clicked on that, it played my original demos, which were the things that it was like, no one will ever hear these. These must never, ever go out into the world. But hidden deep on the American DVD of The Devil's Music, it had me going, right, it kind of goes like this, just these awful caterwauling versions of the thing. So I'm kind of oddly proud of that in a way. But yeah, so I've got form for doing this.
Oh, very good. So, like, when you were getting the kind of production together, how kind of quickly did the once you and Charlie were like, okay, this is getting made now, and you had your like, how quickly did the cast come together?
The cast was one of those things where I think we ended up with, I think it's fairly safe to say, we ended up with a different cast because of lockdown. Because what we actually ended up doing was a load of table reads, online table reads with people, not necessarily, they weren't even necessarily really auditioning, but if we knew people who were bored actors, and particularly in that first lockdown, nobody was working, everybody was fed up with things. And so we just kind of put out feelers and said, look, we're going to table read the whole movie, just over a Zoom call for an hour and a half, do you want to come along and read one of them? And loads of people just went, yeah. And we did that a whole bunch of times. And in the course of doing that, it not only did it give us a chance to talk to people that we hadn't worked with before, or to see how people that we maybe had worked with before might take on a certain role. And it was fun as well. It was just a fun kind of groovy thing to do. And in the course of that, we kind of organically, quite a lot of them, it was like, yeah, you know what? I think, this person would fit that role. And I think a lot of the casting kind of came about that way, where sometimes we might have had a nagging idea that maybe this person or that person, but to just be able to go, let's read the whole movie. And then you can see different chemistry between different people and all that sort of thing. And it was just a fun thing to do over lockdown. So we did a whole bunch of table reads, which is kind of fascinating. I've got them all on the hard drive somewhere. But that was great, and it was partly for fun, and it was part of the casting process, I suppose, because we certainly weren't going to be meeting people in rooms. We did a few, so we asked a few people to do self tapes as well, but the core thing of it was just these long table reads, and I did it for some other scripts as well. There were some other screenwriters who I get on with, where they had scripts that were kind of nearly finished or three quarters finished, and like with these same kind of groups of people that we were doing online stuff, we just said, hey, can we all let's all get together and do a table read for it? And that was really interesting, organizing ones that were actually for other screenwriters, because I think I'd only ever taken part in table reads, or virtual or otherwise, that were my own stuff. And so we were suddenly, I was organizing ones for other screenwriters just for the fun of it, really. And also potentially, from a slightly cynical point of view, for me to be able to see sometimes people we were thinking of casting, to be able to see them read another role in something completely different, just because you kind of get a different performance and stuff. But yeah, so we kept ourselves busy in lockdown. And a lot of it came together during that phase, I suppose. And in fact, there were points where, the COVID never went away. Obviously, it's still here now. But during filming, there were points where it was a nightmare because obviously, if we had either cast or crew members going sick, or we had changes in terms of the rules or things like that that made certain things impossible to shoot, or that we had to shoot around them or whatever. But every now and again, you would get things where it actually kind of broke our way. Like there's a sequence in a really lovely restaurant that we were able to shoot in because normally that restaurant would be open 7 days a week and you'd never get the chance for a little indie movie to block the restaurant out for the whole thing. But as because of COVID, they were only operating a takeaway service. So the entire air restaurant seating area, they weren't using sort of day after day. So we kept it a very, very small crew, masked and distanced, and we were able to get some beautiful looking shots in there that otherwise we'd have just never got the opportunity to do that. So COVID presented some bad challenges, but it also did present some different ways of looking at stuff, I guess.
Sure.
I don't think that's what you asked me. Sorry, sometimes I just
No, it's okay. No, I initially asked about the casting of the movie, but no, I mean it's all interesting stuff, and it's like it is interesting how, I've talked to a lot of people who COVID has affected their film, obviously. COVID has affected everything. But it's interesting how, in some ways, it has also created new opportunities. Like I've talked to a lot of people, for example, who have had their films like play at various festivals digitally. And of course, the downside is you don't get to see it with an audience. The upside is more people have the opportunity to see it. For example, like in 2020, I for the podcast covered Fright Fest and Grim Fest from Scotland. And obviously, I wouldn't be able to do that in a normal year, because you would just have to be in those, be at those festivals to cover those festivals. But because they were digitally and you could just get a digital pass and watch all the movies, I was able to do that. And like, so people across the UK didn't have to be in London or Manchester to view those movies. They could view them across the UK, so they got like a wider spread. So there is these kind of things that it's kind of taken away, but also like kind of people have found kind of new opportunities within it as well.
Absolutely. I one of the things that I start to talk about indie filmmaking and stuff at film festivals, and one of the things that I always kind of blather on about is to that if you do something when it's hard, it sometimes makes everything easier. It's which sounds really counterintuitive, but the only reason, I'm nearly 20 years into doing this now, and the only reason that my first movie got distribution was because it was incredibly difficult to shoot movies at the point I shot my first one, because celluloid was still prohibitively expensive, and the technology really wasn't there to be shooting digital. And we did shoot digital, but that meant that we were one of only 16 British horror movies that year. Whereas now, the marketplace is so astonishingly crowded because you can pick up a digital device and shoot a movie very easily, and so people do. So if you do it when it's hard, then all the other stuff falls into place much easier. The fact that we shot a movie when it was incredibly hard to do so meant that when it came to distribution, the distributors were like, "Oh, you've got a movie. Wow, okay." There aren't many of them around. And that meant that we kind of made it into, every blockbuster in the country kind of thing. Whereas if I'd have been trying to launch my career, I don't know how I'd have done it now, where there is, so much product, there are so many movies out there, because it is easy to shoot, to just set something going for an hour and a half, shoot something in HD or 4K or, whatever. That's the easy bit now. The hard bit is getting people to watch it. or at least to create something that's engaging within those parameters, or that's different enough, and all those sorts of things. But so the same with COVID, really, and the same with that. If you look at obstacles as a potential boon, because it's going to stop other people. You know, if there is a difficulty, you know, whatever that difficulty is, if it comes along and it stops some of your competition from going ahead with their projects, that's exactly when you need to make sure that yours is one of the ones that carries on, because then there'll be a dip in terms of how much product out in the marketplace and all those sorts of things coming up. So I do kind of run directly towards it'll make your thing stand out if you're the one that's fought through stuff. Because if you're only doing stuff when stuff's easy, you're going to find that at the end of your journey, you're competing with a million other people who've gone and done it with it. So, yeah, I like to get the tough bit out of the way first.
yeah, I can understand that. So I was wondering as well, like, just kind of coming back to the casting, was there anybody that you particularly, what, you know, like, you kind of got it through the kind of table reads and people you kind of just put it out to? Was there anybody you particularly wanted to come on board with the film or had in mind?
There's an actor called Sahenti who's been in everything I've ever shot. Okay. I think, but I've no idea why. You know, I often joke that he's got some kind of terrible blackmail material on me or something like that. It's just there is a natural, when I say I have no idea why, he's an astonishingly talented actor, but the idea that for two decades I've been unable to shoot anything without then going, and I need to put Sy Henty in this. So Sy's in it, but he was built into the script. The script just has a character, you know, in the action description it just says, you know, Neil turns around and he is Sy Henty, I've made it this far, he's kind of got to be. But as far as other people, when we had some ideas, there were some people that I'd wanted to work with. I wanted to work with Danny Thompson, who works in a lot of horror movies, and I'd met a bunch of times at film festivals and things like that. And so Danny and I had chatted loads and loads of times, but we'd never actually worked together. And so I was quite eager to get her on board with the project. And a lot of the time it was about finding new people that we hadn't worked with before, and just being blown away by how versatile or something about their performance when it came to those table reads. And we've been lucky enough to have appearances by, we've got Paul Zenon's in it, David Charles in it. And so we've had these other people who are kind of very recognizable in fields adjacent to horror stuff, you know, maybe more other forms of film, or, you know, in Paul's case, the magic. And so it's lovely to have those kind of recognizable faces in a slightly different context in the movie. That's been a real boon for us as well, and they're wonderful people to work with.
And you must be good to work with yourself, because
I'm Danny, amazing.
Danny Thompson was one of the many people when I put a call out amongst former guests to be like, who do you know that you think would be good to have on the show? So he was one of one of three. Danny Thompson, Carl Holt, who directed Benny Loves You, and Tom Lee Rutter.
Fantastic. Well, I'm very, Bellini, I'm
which,
very.
They all highly recommended honored. Having
I'm
you
very,
on the show.
I'm very, very honoured. And they're, what a trio to be recommended by. All absolutely wonderful, talented human beings. Actually, Cole's Benny Loves You, I think it's just. It was one of those movies where I've followed it. I saw, have you seen the original short? It was an original short called Eddie Loves You in 2006.
Yes, like when I was researching the interview, I.
Oh, and I saw that. That was my first ever dealings with Carl, the first time I ever became aware of him. I saw that at a festival. I think it was on the same day as one of my movies. So we traveled to the festival to support my own film, and that short, it came on and it just took the roof off. You know, one of those ones where you just sit in awe and you just kind of go, that is a connection with an audience. And so it's so wonderful to then see that kind of expanded into feature length, like a decade, more than a decade later, in such fine style. So, oh, that's lovely to have been recommended by them. Thank you for telling me.
Yeah. I didn't see it at the time. I just saw, like I say, after I was just one of those things of at the when I was watching movies for Fright Fest in 2020. That was one of the movies that played, and I was like, I really like this movie, and I reached out to Carl and interviewed him on the show, and so yeah.
Tom as well, who again I think is just creating such incredible, really unique visionary stuff. It's the lifeblood of the industry. The people where there's something genuinely uncanny in their work, and as you say, Cabella and the Witch Elm, just stunning stuff. So, oh, that's really great.
Yes, I'm just slowly joining the dots, and I've talked about this before, in kind of British indie horror. I'm just slowly joining the dots. I kind of got through to people through different way. I talked to Tom through Sam Mason Bell, and I talked
Right,
to I ended up. I think I talked to Danny through MG Dixon, and
we all know one another.
yeah, that's
Great.
me. I'm just slowly creating a map of just kind of
Yes.
connecting all the dots. I feel like kind of it's. I feel like it's kind of getting to the stage where it's like kind of like Panini stickers. Like I'm just slowly collecting them all. I'm not there yet, but like
No, you'll get
anyway.
there. Collect the set, man.
The full British indie horror set.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's one of those. It's one of those things, I think, where you do only normally see people who dip in and dip out will only normally see a part of the puzzle. And it is strange, I think, as you actually spend longer and longer immersed in that particular kind of subculture, you do kind of realize, oh, well, everybody does know everybody. And it's like, here's this link from this person to this person and this person to this person. And yeah, it's kind of fascinating. And then you rock up somewhere like, as I say, ho the Horror on Sea Festival, which is my one of my kind of regular stomping grounds. I tend to do like an hour long talk. In fact, I have done every single one since Horror on Sea started. So the great thing about that festival is pretty much all the people you've just mentioned, you can walk out into the bar and that we're all just there. It's like, it doesn't happen all that often. Because somewhere like Fright Fest, where an awful lot of us will be present at that point, but there's so many people. Whereas something like Horror on Sea, where it's that bit sort of more intimate in terms of physical numbers of people, that then you walk into the bar and you look around and you go, oh, I know them. It's just everyone there. It's great.
Oh, I like yeah, I think yeah, I've definitely interviewed quite a lot of people who regularly go to Horror on Sea, it has to be said.
Horror, it's a good old fest. It really is. It's Paul Cockgrove, who runs it, has just done an amazing job of building it up from nothing over the course of 10 years. And it's such a lovely, warm festival. And I'm not just saying that because they give me my own show every year. There are it champions the really indie spirit, and I've seen movies there that I otherwise feel that I'd have never got the chance to see. A lot of them are British, that sometimes they're from loads of kind of different other places where, again, you might not have ever just come across them before, but everything that gets sent through to them, they kind of check through it. And yeah, it's a lovely pioneering little festival.
Yeah, I've definitely got I feel like I'm getting close to getting the full Panini collection of the Horror and Sea people, because other than the people mentioned, we've already mentioned, I've also interviewed Alex Churchyard and Michael Holliday about their film I Scream on the Beach, and I've also interviewed
Crumbs.
Martin W. Payne, who's starred in a lot of
Nice.
movies with
Who's also in Power Tool Cheerleaders? Versus the boy band of the Screeching Dead. I nearly broke my own rule there, but it was just a
Oh,
fake out. It was a fake out to keep
damn.
you paying attention. I was always going to say the full title. I wasn't just going to tail off after those first two
okay.
words.
Just a little bit of a riff there. I'm still trying to find new ways of saying it. Tool Cheerleaders versus the boy band of the Screeching. That's very kind of Radio 4. I've gone Radio 4 yes. now. Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the boy band of the Screeching Dead. okay. So I don't know, like I feel like I'm just going to end up irritating my listeners. It's like, okay, right, you've done this joke into the ground now.
It never bothers me. I'll drag out the same gags for movie after movie. It never seems to, you know, how many is too many? Not sure. I'll know when I get there. And
oh dear. I mean, the podcast has been going on for over 110 episodes now, so I'm sure listeners are used to me driving bits into the ground, you know, like
excellent. You got rid of any lightweights along those 110. You know, any ones who are only going to put up with a joke like five times, you know, they're gone, man. They're in the dust somewhere. You know, we just got the hardcore who are like, yeah, say the title again. Say it like you're selling me insurance.
Oh, dear. So, kind of coming back to it, I was going to ask, what was the... Other than COVID, was there a bit of the film that was like the kind of most difficult aspect of making the film, or was it really just the kind of just filming under COVID conditions?
Scheduling has been an absolute nightmare with it because it's quite a large cast, as in that we've got sort of, you know, a power cheer who are our central cheerleading group, you know, are obviously five cast members. And then we have our boy band, the Starmen, who are another three. And so really, if you've got a day where you've got both the power cheer and the Starmen, and then you've got obviously the need for a producer, director, a sound recordist, you know, all the normal kind of thing, director of photography, all of those sort of people that you need to have on set, it suddenly becomes a scheduling headache because just, you know, it's not like doing two people stuck in a lift. You know, if you've got something that's very locked down and just one location, this has a lot of locations. It's got a lot of songs. It's got a lot of whatever. And we had a large cast. And so from a scheduling point of view, that stuff was very difficult to manage on an ongoing basis. And it's one of the reasons, you know, it has been... not in terms of days of shooting, but in terms of logistics, in terms of, you know, we shot our first shots for it over a year ago, and we've still got pickups scheduled next month, you know. So all of those sort of things mean that the logistics of it was tough. But it's, you know, I think that pays off because a lot of, it's that same thing about running towards the stuff that's hard because, yeah, that means... it is harder to schedule, but then you've actually got a nice, you know, larger cast and all those sorts of things that aren't necessarily things that you see in low budget horror movies, because a lot of the time you will get a cast of three people in one location because that's the easiest thing to manage. And it's only mad teams like us who kind of go, no, we're going to have loads and loads of people across loads and loads of locations. And it makes it harder, but hopefully it means that you can give people something they haven't seen in quite the same way. On movies that are low enough budget to be able to take the kind of mad risks that we can. I mean, I think that's one of the things, that the freedom that comes with an independent budget versus, you know, if you're working with an existing IP or you're working for a studio or you're working whatever, there's so much money at stake, everybody's completely risk averse. Mm-hmm. And then when you're on a very low budget, you can take those risks, but sometimes money stops you going, you know, because you've got to go, I'd like to make it a musical. And then you look in the bank account and you go, yeah, but that's going to take much more time and much more, you know, and all of those sorts of things. So I think it is that balance between embracing the freedom that comes with the very low budget, but not then talking yourself out of doing anything interesting and just going, oh, I'll just have three people in a room and one of them's going to kill one of them, you know. So yeah, I think it's walking that fine line.
I mean, I absolutely get that, you know, because there is more of a blank canvas. You don't have like lots of producers giving you lots of notes and stuff like that.
No,
but at the same time, I mean, just in terms of like, sometimes your imagination can be bigger than the money that is available to you.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've been guilty that, you know, looking back through other stuff throughout my career, I have been guilty of writing scripts that are like, you know, here's a 10 million script. We're going to do it for $9,000. And those kind of, you know, the first ever review I got in Empire, my first movie, the first review we ever got was Clever Ideas, Dodgy Tech Credits. And you just kind of, yep, it was overreach. It was, you know, but we got the movie out there. So, but it is a balance.
I mean, well, you got out there enough to get it reviewed in Empire. You know, there's thousands of movies, you know, like this is,
yeah.
Not everything gets reviewed, you know.
No, absolutely. But actually, luckily, it's because I'm so, because I've been doing this so bloody long, that it, you know, that was that one where going back to that same thing I said about doing it when it's hard, because yeah. That was the movie where we were doing, when nobody else was doing it. So actually getting reviewed in major publications wasn't necessarily the tricky bit. Whereas now, if you've got 100 movies all coming out, you know, whereas at that point you had so much less competition. If you made it to the point where you're sitting on the shelf of Blockbuster, you're much more likely to actually get reviewed, because that was the tough bit, or at least to actually make the movie exist. But now there's still a million obstacles. It's not easy. It's just different difficulties.
Yeah, I mean, like I remember thinking that a lot throughout 2020, of being. You know, because obviously on this podcast, I talk to indie horror filmmakers and, you know, very invested in independent horror. And, you know, obviously there's your typical sites that review kind of everything horror, you know, like Bloody Disgusting and, you know, things like that,
yeah.
Fangoria, you know, whatever. But like I noticed like during lockdown and stuff, there was a lot of weird stuff that was getting reviewed in like The Guardian, yes. And stuff. And I was like, oh, what? Well, that's getting a review. Oh,
yeah.
Incredible. Look.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And you get those movies where they just hit them. I mean, you know, for me, Host was the perfect example, where it was just a movie that hit its moment, you know, like a superstar stepping onto a mark. I mean, boom, my God, what a moment to drop that perfectly formed bubble of a movie. And then, you know, we were all sat in lockdown, we've all been sitting on Zoom thing, to then sit and watch this perfectly crafted little Zoom horror movie was just amazing. But it is the kind of, you know, come the moment, come the film kind of thing. And yeah, it's about that perfect timing, because, you know, 3 months further down the line, where other people had done badly executed Zoom movies, I don't know if Host would have been able to do such a perfect landing. But the fact that it was the first of its kind and it was just perfect, like a diamond, you know, it was its moment.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then, like, that was one of those movies that kind of took me aback, because, you know, of how much it kind of, it just hit that perfect moment of, like, you see, if it come out, like, a few months later, it probably wouldn't have made such a big impact. But because it was like, oh, what's this new funky thing, like, this movie across Zoom, it got all this publicity in places you do not expect independent horror to, you know. It was like it entered the mainstream, and I heard, you know, it saw it like being covered on like The Guardian, the BBC, you know, things like this. And then people in the mainstream on Twitter and stuff, not just kind of horror Twitter, which I exist on, but like, you know, like generally it's like, oh, what? I was like, oh, you know. And like you say, it's just that perfect timing thing.
Yeah, and it was. I love the fact that it, as I say, that it was so perfect done, and it was first. Because quite often that doesn't happen. It's like the first one out the gates is this thing where it's like an idea that half works, where they haven't quite honed it enough, or they haven't quite whatever. But it stepped out as the first one and did it best. And you just got to go, right, that's that, boys. You know, that's that done, man. What else is there to say? I didn't watch Host and go, I need to shoot a horror movie over Zoom, because someone's just made the perfect one and they dropped it at the perfect time. So, you know, yeah, did it.
you know, you've mentioned a few times you've been like doing this for like 20 years now, and like I was wondering, you know, like often when I have people on the show who are like new filmmakers who are maybe making their first or second feature, I often ask them, you know, like, oh, what's it like, you know, is there a big step up from like making shorts to making features and stuff like that? But you know, because you've been in the game a long time now, I was more wondering, does directing get easier, or is each project of a similar level of difficulty?
I think I've been trying to shift my directing focus. I always believe I'm always learning, as is everyone. And I don't ever want to think just because I've done something a bunch of times that I haven't got something new to learn from it. So in terms of directing, over the last couple of years, I've been doing a lot more reading about dealing with cast, about different strategies for dealing with different actors and stuff like that. Because, you know, every time I kind of look back on things, I think that relationship, the relationship between the director and the cast, can be completely different depending on the circumstances of the shoot. Now, looking back, as I say, over the decades, I'm not a very good cameraman. As a camera operator, I'm not great. I can step in and do it if needs, is kind of where we are. But one of the things that I've noticed looking back in terms of that balance is that, so on the Death Tales movies, in fact, I think on both of the Death Tales movies, for at least for the majority of my sections in those Death Tales movies, I was the camera op. So I had no director of photography. They were done very, very, very low budget. So we would have a sound operator, I would be operating camera, and I would be directing. Now, one of the things, looking back on the years that I've done this, one of the things that I realized about that is that it means that my visuals look worse because I am not a skilled director of photography. As I say, Al Ronald, who's a DOP on Power Tool, is just amazing. The man's a wizard with light. I don't know how he does it. I'm just incredibly grateful that he does, and that, you know, that we've got him kind of with us. But one of the things that I did notice is that although on movies where I've had to grab the camera myself, just through lack of resources or anything like that, the camera work might be worse, but I think it makes my relationship with cast easier, because I think that you've got the part of your brain that is otherwise watching somebody else do another job, there's something removed from that process. So you are the one pointing the camera at that person, and you are the one able to give instruction to that person. And every time a crew grows, it adds another variable into that mix. And so because you have to vocalize as a director to your DOP, and quite often cast can overhear or engage in that conversation, I think every time you add another step into the conversation, something gets lost in the frequency. And so I find it a little bit frustrating looking back that the movies where I'm least happy with the camera work, because it's been me holding the camera, and this is not my, that is not the reason I make movies. It's not because I'm an exceptionally skilled camera person. But I've realized that going back to it, if it is me holding the camera, that actually really enhances my relationship with my cast, because it's a step gone where it's not me talking to someone else about how I want them to film them, and so all of those little things I think can change things hugely as a director. And I've often wondered on, because I've never, you know, the stuff that I work on, I sometimes work on higher budget projects, just I do uncredited script rewrites sometimes on both sides, both here and in the States. And I've worked on bigger budget stuff there, but I've never stood on set on what you would consider a quote unquote Hollywood budget. And I've often wondered, you know, although I've directed an awful lot of gigs over the years, I thought, I don't know how the dynamics would work with that large a crew. And I don't know how those chains of communication in terms of the way a director talks to their cast, I don't know if that there'd be more blockages there or what. You know, it is one of those things where you think if the budget increases in some ways, it makes things easier in some ways, but harder in others. And that sheer, there's something about being the one who's holding the camera and pointing that at a person, and then being able to work with that person about finding something in the character, that it's almost like every time you add another notch of detachment to that. I don't know how you'd be able to capture that on a Hollywood set, but unless anyone's going to give me $100 million, I guess I'll never find it.
I suppose not. I mean, like, it's not like a lot of kind of big time filmmakers, like, you know, hold their own camera. I mean, apart from Steven Soderbergh, that's like the only.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple out there, I guess, but it's, I've noticed that because I was trying to work on my communication with cast, and that's kind of been my mental focus as a director over the last couple of years, just thinking, I'm sure I can improve this, because there are some cast where if I've worked with them over and over and over and over again, someone like Sahenti, as I say, who I've never had a set where Sahenti hasn't stepped onto it at some point. Sai and I know one another. I know, you know, I know the rhythms of his performance. I know how far he can push himself in different directions. But if I'm just working with someone who I've never worked with before, and maybe I'm only going to work with them for that day, I want to be able to make sure that I can generate some kind of rapport, that find something in their performance and all those, you know, to get all of those connections as good as they can possibly be. Because I figure that I owe it to my cast as well as to the movie to be able to get that connection as good as it can be. And so I like the idea of bettering myself as a director. Whether or not I will ever succeed, I don't know. But I'm always trying, man. I'm always trying.
I'm sure you will. And I look forward to, like, when the Pearl Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of Screeching Dead is released. And that segues nicely to you telling us about the release. This episode will come out sometime in early in the new year, but as I understand, actually, the interview is being recorded now in December, and I understand that it is coming out this month. This month being the month we're recording in, not the month, if that's not confusing for the listeners.
it's not out yet. It's going to be, it'll be hitting some of the festivals in 2022. It will be hitting the festival circuit. Whether we hit the deadlines for a couple of the ones that we're really hoping to be in, which I won't say for fear of jinxing it, but we're hoping that we'll hit, you know, we've got our wish list of fests all over the world that we very much hope to hit. We've also had all these mad ideas for different stuff. We're doing one of the Kickstarter perks was that one of the very, very first screens of it that we're ever going to do, we're going to drag some of the cast on stage afterwards and sing some of the songs live. So I think that's just gonna be fun. And so I love the idea of doing stuff like that. I love the idea. Charlie and I talked about doing a drive-in screening of it at some point, and, you know, having, you know, live dancers and fireworks. And, yeah, I love all that sort of thing. The idea of a screening not just being a screening, of it being more of an interactive experience, a night to remember. But whether we'll actually pull any of those off, we won't have any money at that point. So it'll come down to what is doable, but we'll certainly be hitting as many of the festivals.
We'll keep a track of that, and we will share anything on the New Horror Express Twitter and all that stuff. And look forward to checking that out when we can, and give people dates when we can do that. But that seems like a nice place to kind of bring the interview to a close, and it just leaves me to thank you very much for coming on to the show to talk about, and I'll say it one more time, big finale, Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead.
Oh, that was the that was the one. That was like the Circus Barker one. That was great. That had a real showmanship to it. I loved it. Thank you, man. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been awesome. Thank you for your time, and keep it up with it. I love the fact that you're drawing the network together. You're slowly you're shining lights into all the areas of the Indie Horror Network. where people don't dare to peek normally, and you're there pioneering and showing your light. So thanks, man.
That was my guest, Pat, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. Plus, as always, I'd like to thank you, the listener, for checking out this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Plus, if you can make those reviews 5 stars, that would be great, as otherwise the algorithm thinks that we are shit. And you wouldn't want that in your conscience now, would you? Anyway, that is all for this time, but be sure to join me next time when I'll have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.